Hey, what's going on? This is Carlo of 4GQ TV, and we have a very special interview today with Derek Robertson, who has done a lot of work and lately known for The Boys. And we'll go into him in just a second here. Real quick, I want to introduce the panel as fast as possible. We have Paris, who is from the Marvel Cinematic Facebook group, the largest Facebook group for Marvel. What's going on, Paris?
Hey, what's going on, Carlo?
We have Gary, who is a panelist on 4GQ TV. What's going on?
Not bad. Thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
And we have Alan across the pond, who is a panelist on 4GQ TV. What's going on?
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you for having me. All good.
Absolutely. And we have the guest of the half hour, the guest of the moment, Derek Robertson. What's going on?
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, absolutely, man. Really excited to get to talk to you. I know that we started talking online a little bit about Space Beaver, but I want to let you to go. I want to let you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm Derek Robertson. I'm known for co-creating Transmetropolitan and The Boys and Happy, which Boys and Happy turned into TV shows. So you might know me from that. I've also worked in mainstream comics for about 38 plus years. So I used to be the regular artist on Wolverine for a while. I worked on Justice League and recently wrote and drew Batman Legends of the Dark Knight number one. So I drew Spider-Man, wrote some Spider-Man stories. So, you know, I write a little bit. I'm known for my drawing and I co-created some stuff that people seem to like.
Awesome. Yeah, no, you've created a lot of stuff that people like. You're very, very creative, very humorous, very talented. Every character that you've mentioned, also Space Beaver, by the way, I am a fan of.
And Space Bastards.
That's right, Space Bastards too, which I actually got to get.
Space Bastards, it's quite the legacy.
It is. So what got you into all of this? How did you get started in this?
Well, it started, how far back do you want to go? I mean, I've drawn since I was a little boy. I've always had a love for drawing and comics of some sort. It was about 10 years old, 9 or 10 years old when I discovered superhero comics and fell in love with those. Up until then, it was like kind of any comic would do. I liked Archie and Richie Rich and Bugs Bunny and, like, you know, like the Gold Key Looney Tunes card comics, things like that. Because a lot of times comics would just find me. I didn't really know that you could go somewhere and buy them. I'd get them for free from like my dad's barber, you know, stuff like that. So comics sort of just found their way to me. But the first time I discovered comic books for myself was Flash 272, which is not a great issue or anything, but it's got an excellent cover, which drew me in. But I was suddenly really in love with the sequential art of it. Rich Buckler drew that issue, and just seeing the Flash in the different motions in his trail, like, I really got the sense of him moving, and something awoke inside of me at that point. Like, it was like seeing somebody do a magic trick and kind of figuring out, like, oh, that's a skill, you know. I wanted to learn how to draw comics from then on. And so I kind of fell in love with creating superheroes and my own comic books that I would just, you know, stapling typing paper together, but and then making it look like a comic book. But those early efforts, it's like kind of a nonstop arc to where I am right now. So I didn't go to school. I was just, barely made it out of high school because all I wanted to do was draw. And I was kept told that I was going nowhere, and they were right. but comics has worked out for me, so that's kind of how I got here. But it's as far as professionalism goes, though. When I was around 16 or 17, I came up with the idea for a character named Space Beaver just because I was bored in summer school and started writing and drawing what would become the first, you know, 8 pages of issue one. But just panel by panel, making it up as I go, literally just to pass the time. I had the idea for the name which made me laugh. And I didn't, Gary, you'll appreciate this. I didn't know that beaver was a euphemism because I was a kid. So I, you know, could have liked badgers more and it would have been a whole other, swing to the comic. But unfortunately, well,
Alan would know this. Fanny is definitely different in America as in England as well. So it's
and luckily I wasn't a big fan of roosters because then who knows what I but I liked the animal. I like otters and beavers and, you know, those kind of animals. But anyway, I made up the character just for fun and it turned into something. By the time I was graduating high school, I was doing pages for the interior of issue one in my high school senior art school or art class. And the teacher just said, like, whatever you're working on, just keep going. I'm going to be over here with the rest of the class. So I was like, thank you.
Wow.
And there was a guy named Tibor Sardi who owned a store back then in my town called Peninsula Comics. And I would go in there to get my comics. And he saw what I was working on. And it was going to be like a backup feature in some black and white comic that, you know, I was just happy that someone was willing to print it, publish it, and they weren't going to pay me or anything. And he was like, no, this is too good. It has to be its own thing. And so, bless his heart, the 10 Buck Comics was born. And the only thing they ever published was that 11 issues of Space Beaver.
Oh, nice.
It was right at the beginning of the black and white boom ending, which is the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles had started it, and Space Beaver was right there for the finale, where, you know, at the time, these comics would come out and they'd be worth, you know, 10 bucks overnight, which is why originally Tibor wanted to call it 10 bucks already, and then it became 10 Buck Comics to be shortened, because he was a store owner, and I think he also thought he was going to print money. He didn't. And we struggled, and Space Beaver, it's got this weird, lovely cult following that people, you know, it's the people that liked it really liked it. And most people just have never seen it. So, and that's okay, because it was just a way for me to get my career going. And from there, I started going to conventions and selling my sketches and meeting people in the industry. And it wouldn't work like that now, but that's how it worked back in the 80s.
Nice. Well, it does definitely have a cult following. Carlo is one of those people that follows it a lot. So that's pretty cool that it's out there like that, you know, and you just never know. It could just explode one day and they're going, guess what I'm doing, folks?
Maybe. I've been hearing that since 1987. So it hasn't happened yet. Although it came this close to being a TV show at the end of the 80s. I had a producer that was like, I still have the pitch packet and everything, but this producer had sold it to or was trying to sell it as a number of cartoons he was going to produce. He didn't get funding and it didn't go anywhere, but he had worked on Rocky and Bullwinkle and won Emmys and stuff, so he was a legit guy. But then I found out at that time that Hollywood had changed under his feet, kind of like the way I'm experiencing how comics have changed in their mind. So but it was almost something.
So
just to piggyback on the, you said you were approached by someone to do Space Beaver as a show. What, so we've seen this success with Marvel and, you know, DC-ish success, I guess you could say, heavily criticized but still successful. What got you, or were you first approached to start, you know, hey, I want to take your comic and make it into a live action piece of some sort? When that started, did that start creeping in your mind, like, hey, when if something takes off, I could kind of take it to the next level? Or were you approached by saying, hey, can I use this and you can kind of hang on as a executive producer type thing?
I'm not totally sure I understand your question. Are you
so asking? Okay. Yeah, like I have ADD. Okay, so
that's
everywhere.
So like, okay, so jump in on that.
Okay, so for example, like, for The Boys, were you approached about turning it into a live action show?
Yeah, right after we left DC Comics, when DC canceled us, because they very kindly, it sounds terrible, but it really was quite nice the way it was handled. I had nothing against DC. They just decided they didn't want to be publishing that, so they gave us our rights back and we were able to take it elsewhere. And they could have made our lives a nightmare if they wanted to be awful about it, and they weren't in the slightest. They actually made things quite amicable, and they wanted, and they maintained a relationship with me, which I still have with them. But they felt it was too hot for their brand, and understandable. If you look through the original Wildstorm number one of The Boys, you'll see, like, you know, my horrible abuse of superheroes doing nasty things right next to ads for like Justice League and Batman. And those two worlds were never supposed to intersect. So, you know, right. For us, it was, we wanted to take off and do our own universe. And it was more about the archetypes than it was specifically those characters. It was never supposed to be like, I don't think Superman and Homelander would get along at all. Like,
never
do that. No.
Yeah. And that's one. I was going to say, that's one of the main attractions for me for The Boys, in my humble opinion, is that it brings sort of that humanity back to the characters. Because if you look at the human race right now, right, if people had superpowers, you must best believe some folks would be abusing it, right? It's natural
that's,
order.
And that's right? Kind of what it kind of, that's what the whole root of that story always was, is about, you know, what people with extreme power would do. Like, and that's what Garth Ennis wanted to pull into the original idea, was that people, you know, that had that kind of power, they wouldn't just naturally be good people. They would be tempted to use their power the way celebrities and politicians do. And so that's why that whole world kind of works. And it really works, getting back to your question, Gary, on TV. So when we left DC and got set up at Dynamite, we were approached almost immediately by Neil Moritz's Kickstart, and they wanted to make a movie trilogy of it. And we were very excited, but I learned a hard lesson about how Hollywood works, and that's things go very, very slowly, and they almost happen, and then they don't happen, and then they almost happen, and then they don't happen. So we were on that roller coaster for about 11 years before, if it weren't for Eric Kripke, literally being in love with the book, I don't know that the show would ever have actually happened. So he got a hold of it and managed to work his way back to Sony TV out of the movie department. Movies had already dropped it and put it into turnaround, which is a term which means, like, if they have an option of something and then they decide not to make it and they let it go, then somebody else can come in and option it because it's in turnaround. So that's where we were for a long time, but it really was Eric Kripke's passion and Seth Rogen's and Evan Goldberg's excitement for the project that all that was able to come together and become the show that it is. And the response to the show has just been amazing. I'm really happy with kind of answering your question further, Gary. Like, I love what they've done with the show. They're doing their own thing. It's not exactly our comic, but I'm really okay with that, because I think the two work independently of each other, as well as I know there's love and respect for the things that make the comic tick and the characters feel and look right. So it does work as a TV show, but you couldn't do the comic verbatim anyway and have it really come together.
Right.
So just to add on, piggyback on that, you say you love the way that they're doing it. So have they asked you like any type of like things to do, like to add to the character or anything like that? Have they asked for your input at all? Have they asked for your input at all?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, in the beginning, especially when Kripke was first had gotten the property and it was a definite go, he sat down with me before he started writing at San Diego Comic-Con. He sat down with me at San Diego Comic-Con before he started writing. And he wanted to know what was important to me. And he had already talked to Garth. And what was important to me was, I said, well, one thing is that it needs to be funny. If it's not funny, it's just going to be a long, hard slog, and people will dial out and get burnt out on the gore and the awfulness of this world. So if there's no comedy in it, I don't think it'll work. And he agreed. And then one of the things I really wanted was, I said, are you going to include the scene where Huey's holding Robin's hands? And he said, I wasn't sure why. And then I explained, I said, I really think that that's important, and explained why, because I think that's the jumping off moment for most of the fans. It's like the moment you connect with Huey, then the whole world kind of makes sense to you. And like, if you don't have that emotional core and that attachment to Huey's loss, I don't think the rest of it makes a whole lot of sense, because through Huey's loss, you come to understand Butcher's loss And through Butcher's loss, you start to understand all of the boys have lost something to these horrible people, and nobody gets held accountable. And that's makes it exciting when they do. And Kripke totally agreed, and that scene's in there. And what's a great example of the difference between how comics work and how movies work is how Dan Trachtenberg, the director of that episode, the first episode, he went in there and he slowed everything down. And so it all happens in this kind of strange time warp. And it, but it rather than the way we presented it in the comic and the way I originally saw it, which was, you know, Huey's having a good time and boom, she's just gone, you know, like poof. And he can't even process what's happened until he realizes he's holding her hands. By dragging it down and the little bit of blood hitting the face and all that, it's like, it works so much better visually by the way he chose to handle it. It completely works. And yet it's two totally different approaches to the same scene.
Yeah. I think just to give you all a story real quick. I just want to say what you said right there with the hands and everything, that was perfect, because my mom, 63 years old, doesn't, you know, like new shows. I said, Mom, just watch the first 15 minutes. Watch the first 15 minutes. She watched it. She was hooked. She can't wait for the third season.
Thank you. That's great. Ironically, my wife is the same way. Like, she doesn't like superheroes or sci-fi stuff. I can't get her to watch the Marvel movies. Even though I think she'll like, but she likes Game of Thrones, she likes Sopranos. And so, but she of course had a vested interest in watching this, but she didn't have to like it and she loves it. So like, she's sort of my real world touchstone, because of course I'm going to like it, because I'm like, ah, that's my world, you know, my stuff yeah. brought to life. How, what, you know, and they're sending me checks. Things are good. Right. You know, but the other side of it is that I wasn't really expecting the reaction to the show to be as strong as it's been. And that's been really delightful to see it winning awards. And it's just one of Amazon's most popular, and you know, they're doing spinoffs, you know, things are, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. I think, with the show as well, you can relate a bit more emotionally with someone in a TV series than you can in a comic book. Just that with the whole slowing down and stuff. I think, Huey's been through the ringer, let's be honest. why do they hate him so much? Poor Huey. But you do develop a massive emotional connection with these guys through film, that even in the comics, I know it's there, but with it being on film, it just sort of exasperates that emotional connection.
Yeah, I mean, it could go either way, where it might have just come off as stupid too. You know, like, yeah, you never really know how it's going to connect. I knew I was in good hands with, you know, Eric Kripke after, you know, 15 seasons of Supernatural. I mean, and you know, I liked his other series too, like Revolution and Timeless. You know, he certainly knows how to make a supernatural world, no pun intended, work, or a world with weird powers or those dynamics, because he gets down to the, you know, all of his shows always have very human characters, and that's what makes the boys work. So it's a really nice fit, but you know, in the wrong hands, the show would have been a mess.
Right. Yeah. You can see it quickly sort of like, oh, it's just doesn't make any sense. What are they doing? Superheroes don't act like this. What's going on? Right. Yeah. But then you'll have to go back to people like, go back.
Or just crude for crude's sake, which I never really like. I don't like, even when in the comics, it's like, a lot of people were hard on the comics back in the day, but I have to say, honestly, there was always a root of a heartfelt story in a weird way. Ennis is a true romantic. He brought it into Preacher the same way, that it was never just, I mean, there was horrible stuff happening, but there was always a reason for it or a context for it. Even if it was just for a laugh, there was a context for what you were laughing at, you know? So I really like that about, and I think that's what the core of the show is intact there.
Awesome.
Yeah, I just want to say real quick, Paris, did you have any questions that you want to ask before I go into my question?
Oh, no. Go ahead. I'll jump in off your question. It's all good. We're good to go.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this might be a little bit more of a statement, but I just want to tell you, Derek, so when we first saw the preview for The Boys, my wife was looking at it and she said to me, oh, well, we're not going to watch this. I don't like superheroes. Right. She did the same thing that your wife probably does. You know, my wife
and mine.
Yeah. My wife doesn't like video games, doesn't like too much pop culture, you know. And I started watching The Boys by myself, like maybe the first 15, 20 minutes. And I'm like, wow, this is some insane stuff going on here. Like, I could relate to the characters a little bit because they show a side of humanity that exasperates, you know, a little bit of violence, a little bit of kindness, compassion, anger, greed. Like, there's all this in these characters. Like, they're not perfect. They're flawed characters, which makes them human. Which makes it relatable. So I turned it on for my wife when she got home that night. And I'm like, we're watching this. She's like, oh, I don't like superhero movies. First 20 minutes in, she was glued into the series. And she just felt so much emotion for Yui. And she's like, man, this guy.
Right? Yeah, what I'm saying.
This guy's just unlucky.
Poor Huey.
The hard converted are actually the happier story for me. Did you read the comics back in the day, Carlo, or did you come in via the show?
I heard about it via the show, but then I went on Comixology, and at the time, I think the Comixology had a couple of them for free, a couple of the issues through their Comixology program. So I started looking through them, browsing through them, and then I saw like this story that you created is so in depth. That I put them on the side for now because I know that once I start reading them, I'm not going to want to stop reading the whole series. So I got to set time aside for this.
Yeah, it's great. I did the first, roughly the first 40 issues, and then I got burnt out on the monthly deadline. And so I decided to take the last of my energy and put it towards the Butcher origin story, which is how it wraps up for me. But Russ Braun comes in as the artist and does a great job.
Oh, nice.
But that's but I was curious if you're somebody that came, like, if you haven't read the comics, you can read them. They won't spoil the show because they've already gone in like two different directions. They have, you know, I said the show's doing a great job of bringing characters from the comics in and staying to the heart of it and keeping familiar things from the comics in there, but they're definitely on their own path with their own story, and they've already made some changes that weren't in the comics till much later. And so, you know, you can read them, you could read it and not spoil the show for yourself, I guess is all I'm trying to say.
Awesome. Okay.
Well,
go ahead.
Another question I have for you as a creator, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you've created this and you've created Happy as well. And
couldn't have done any of these without the writers.
Yeah.
So when it comes to like the sets or the casting calls, do you as a creator get an input in that, or is that all decided by the producers and Hollywood?
No, I mean, I had almost no involvement in Happy, but the show, even though it looked exactly like the design I created for the comic. But with The Boys, I've made suggestions, but I'm not like part of that casting room. That's all a huge other undertaking that is handled in a whole separate arena from anything I'm involved in. But the only really happy moment I had, as far as just casting goes, is I started to bug Eric, like, has anybody talked to Simon Pegg? Because Simon wanted to play Huey back in when they first optioned it as a movie. Mm. And after a couple of years of the movie not happening, he kind of said, I think I'm getting too old for the part. And so I was always like, it's not age reliant, because he's a good guy. And I really wanted to see him benefit from me ripping off his face and stuff in my comic book, which he was way too kind about. Don't try that at home, folks.
I got no.
I happened to meet the one probably the nicest guy in all of show business, but and he loves comics, which is why I thought he'd like it, but I didn't have any idea he'd ever really be aware of it. And then he got really, Shaun of the Dead blew up about the same time we were releasing the comics, so it just fell into sync. But I was bugging Eric Kripke, like, hey, has anybody reached out to Simon? And then one day I got the reply, like, he's in my office right now, and they were casting him as Huey's dad. And I was like so glad just to know that he was going to be in it. I ended up flying down to Toronto to be on the set, just to specifically be there to say thank you to him and took him some artwork. And
awesome.
celebrate but, a little bit.
Yeah.
What I really
yeah,
so, like. What I, go ahead, Pierce.
Yeah, yeah. I was just gonna ask. You know, I'm gonna try to tie back into some of the comics that you've created and stuff that you've drawn in the past. So out of you know out of the Marvel and DC comic books that you've actually drawn, like which of your which one is your favorite character in Marvel, and then which one is the favorite character that you've actually drawn in DC? Both of them.
That's tough. like that's hard to say because I love if you see what's surrounding me right now, like I have like a million superhero action figures all over the place hanging from the ceiling. And I love that. I love both universes. So it's really hard for me to go, oh, that one guy is my favorite. Although for me as a career high, rebooting Wolverine with number one, because I was a massive X-Men fan since I was like 13. And all my sketchbooks when I was in high school were filled up with like Nightcrawler and Wolverine hanging out. So the fact that I actually got to draw Nightcrawler and Wolverine ongoing was that was a highlight for me at Marvel. And working with Greg Rucka and Roberto Aguirre Sacasa, like those guys were just fantastic collaborators. Awesome. So that was probably as good as it got for me at Marvel, although you know I loved just about everything I got to do there because I grew up on those characters. But for me, DC was like my first love because I had this Mego action figure of Batman like when I was like four. And that was like my first superhero that I really identified with because he was on TV and Super Friends and I had this action figure of him. And so that action figure was kind of like my teddy bear, like it went everywhere with me. And so just recently I got to write and draw Batman for Legends of the Dark Knight number one, which so I got to reboot Batman. I'm sorry, I got to reboot Wolverine with the number one and then I got to do a Batman number one. So for me, like, that, and I wrote this one. So this one is a real, I wouldn't go so far as to say Batman's my favorite character, but I love him and it was fun writing him. And, but at the same time, like, you know, like the whole Justice League, like there's a reason that I love each one of them. And I think of everybody, the Flash will always have like a special place in my heart. Cause that's the character that got me into comics, like ongoing and, you know, nice. The only superhero symbol I wanted to get a tattoo of was the Flash symbol. I didn't do it. But I was tempted, you know, and
hey,
I
you know, it's never too late. It's never too late to get that.
Yeah, I know. I look at my middle-aged flabby body and go, you know what I need? More tattoos.
More tattoos. Yeah.
Looks so good on flabby old 50-year-olds. But I love the Flash. So it's like, I guess as far as a character goes, but I love that whole universe. Every time I'm drawing them, I got really lucky early on in my career that the first book I got hired to do at DC was Justice League. And that was when they were funny and Giffen and Nematis were writing and Gerard Jones, I got to work with him too on Justice League Europe. And that's when the characters were funny and it was really great drawing them interacting. So I have a special affection for, you know, that Justice League that Kevin Maguire and Adam Hughes brought to life so well. So I don't know, like I have, it's hard to just pick one, you know.
On on the subject of your career as a whole, of course, looking on your website, you're obviously a creator, a designer, an illustrator, a writer, and a producer. I just want to know how difficult that is to control. Do you do all facets of that all at once? Or early in the career, did you start as, so obviously you started as an illustrator?
That sounds a lot cooler
it does sound a lot. But when did that just sort of come naturally along the course of your career? Or was it a case of you've always been all on? If that makes sense.
Yeah, I started out, like I said, my very first comic I was writing and drawing and, I was painting some of the covers, you know, for Space Beaver. So I was doing everything as far as, you know, it's penciling, inking, writing, putting the book together, figuring out the storyline, everything that I was, you know, and I had no idea what I was doing. It was just a labor of love, you know, and like I just let my creativity flow. And it's sort of still like that now. I'm at my happiest when I'm just in my creative space, which is why I was late getting on with you guys, because I was in the middle of inking something and I lost track of time. That still happens. So, you know, I as far as keeping it all together, I have some great people around me that help me, especially my wife. And, you know, I get a lot of time to just focus on being creative, and that's really where I'm at my happiest. And part of the reason I surround myself with action figures and, you know, still watch the movies and everything is because I never want that little spark in me that made me fall in love with this stuff in the first place to go out. So it, wow, awesome. Constantly being around it or having it around me, it keeps that fire alive.
Awesome. Well, that's an interesting question to ask. Was there any point did you feel discouraged in your career? And then at what point did you feel like it sparked it back up to
continue? Many times. There's like the first big hurdle I had was in the mid 90s when I had been I'd come off of this high working for all these companies. Everything was sort of the second big bubble. The first one was the black and white bubble that popped market wise. And the second one was the mid 90s after the Image boom, where Marvel had overextended themselves and declared bankruptcy. And all these comic book stores were closing left and right. And it just didn't look like there was any future in comics. Cause I mean, for me, I that was unthinkable. Like Marvel declaring bankruptcy, like that just, you tell me you can't sell Spider-Man to kids. That's like telling me you can't sell pancakes to hungry people. I mean, right. It's just a natural, but it had happened. Like all these comic book stores were closing and the whole bottom of them. And I couldn't seem to get a monthly book going. And I didn't really sure, like, you know, and I was still pretty young at the time. So I was thinking, you know, maybe I've run my course with this whole comic book thing. I've been doing it since I was 17 and I'm like now in my mid 20s and thinking, well, maybe that's it. Maybe that was a pretty good run there, almost 10 years. And I was thinking I was young enough to maybe still go get an education and do something more respectable. So I was like, hey, I'm good with my hands. Maybe I'll study medicine or something like that and be a doctor, you know. And my wife talked me out of it. She was like, you don't want to do that. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't know if I can't get work doing this, you know, what am I going to do? What am I good for? And she said, they'll figure it out. And it was maybe, you know, 4 months later that I was talking to Warren Ellis about creating this book called Transmetropolitan, and that would become my monthly job. So, you know, that worked out. Nice. 60 issues later.
Brilliant.
Yeah, there you go.
You know, but that was a good example, though, of where what I ended up doing was instead of like holding out hope for getting something from Marvel or DC as a monthly book. And then ironically, I ended up getting offered a Spider-Man book right after I decided to do Transmetropolitan. And I was really on the fence because I wanted to do a monthly Spider-Man book. I'd already done a bunch of fill-ins and miniseries and met many times been offered the replacement spot on Amazing when Bagley was leaving, but then a new editor would get fired or leave and kind of take over and the whole cycle would start over again. So I did one issue of Amazing. But I ultimately, I had a decision to make, and based on some good advice of a friend of mine, I stopped and weighed the fact that, okay, well, I'll do this Transmetropolitan book, and if it flops, Spider-Man's still going to be there. You know, I'll get a job on one of those books, you know, somewhere down the line, if that's what I really want to work for. But if I do this other thing and it's original and I really follow my heart and do something that is inspiring and fun, and I really wanted to work with Warren Ellis at the time, because we had done some superhero books together, and I knew he was going to be an amazing writer, even though he hadn't really been in the spotlight yet. And the idea was so fun and it was so close to my heart. And I really came in and co-created that Transmetropolitan, where a lot of those ideas and things were mine too. And we would just throw stuff off the wall and it would all stick together and it became Transmetropolitan. But by following my heart rather than following, you know, what I thought I should do or what I thought was going to make me money or whatever, I didn't really think about that stuff. I really just went with what I would be happy doing. And I found that that's kind of the secret of life. Like if you're following something that you know it's going to make you happy, or you're happy in the act of pursuing it, even the disappointments are bearable. And so, you know, that's why I think Transmetropolitan did as well as it did in the long term, because it didn't do that well like Space Beaver. It wasn't that popular in the day. But it's much more popular now than it was when we were first publishing it. But I think when people discover it, even now, they can sense that there's an enthusiasm from both of us that comes through in the work that I think when you're having fun on a project, you're drawing or writing or whatever, it's contagious. Other people will pick up on your on the fun that you're having.
Yeah, it ran for 60 issues, so that's an achievement.
Yeah, alone, I did right? every single issue under the weirdest of circumstances too. That was the most tumultuous 5 years of my entire life. Like every major life change you could go through, I went through in the 5 years that I was drawing Transmetropolitan, and I still did every issue.
Awesome!
Wow.
Like I lost, both my parents passed away. I got engaged and married. I moved from San Francisco to Italy, back to San Francisco, and then to New York. And then my first child was born as I was wrapping up Transmetropolitan numbers. It's like the latter part of
Transmetropolitan. Wow.
All that happened in that 5 years.
You like to be a busy boy.
I was, you know, before I had kids, I could draw all night long.
Well, Derek, I just don't know how much more time you have because I just want to do a time check with you. I know
I got another 10 minutes or so if you want to, if you have questions, but
yeah.
So for you, this is something I want to ask Paris, if you don't have any other questions. Paris, do you have any questions before I ask this?
Oh no, go ahead, kind sir. Please go.
I was going to ask you, Derek, any artists or writers that were your inspiration that you looked up to while you were growing up?
Oh yeah, tons of them. I mean, I'm happy because I'm friends with some of them now. But but my major influence for many years has been Brian Bolland. He's still my like A+ example of what I want my work to look like. Mm-hmm. And I think because of just trying to be as good as him, my failed style is what is my style. Like my inability to be as good as Bolland is what led to my current work. But I love him, his work, Frank Frazetta, Mobius, and Mila Minara. I love that kind of UK and European sensibility. That 2000 AD look really had in Dave Gibbons, big influence. Neil Adams, I loved his stuff when I was young. Ross Andrew and Jose Garcia Lopez. Like those guys really inspired. They were all master storytellers. Like there was more going on than just the cool poses, but their anatomy was always tight and the storytelling is impeccable. And so the people that are really good storytellers are the people that really get to me. And like Bernie Wrights, it's a good example too.
Mm-hmm.
Like they can lure you in with like you don't really see, like I think you're doing a better job as an artist if people see the story before they see you. It's almost like being a good actor. You know, like there are actors that are in movies that can play like you think about Robert De Niro. Like Robert De Niro is immediately recognizable as Robert De Niro in every movie, but you don't sit there thinking about Robert De Niro the whole time. Mm-hmm. You think about whatever character it is that he's playing. And that's, I think, the art, the job of a good comic book artist is that, you know, your style can be there but style should come naturally. It shouldn't be something like, here's my style. You know, it should just, most people, it grows out of just a desire to be proficient. And a lot of those guys, I think that's their work speaks to me that way. I see the story before I see the artwork. David Mazzucchelli comes to mind too as an excellent storyteller artist that inspired me.
Yeah. Do you have a certain colorist that you normally bring on with you, or do you just sort of like leave that to the team to decide, you know, who?
No, I have a colorist that I work with pretty closely named Diego Rodriguez, who colored most recently Legends of the Dark Knight #1.
Awesome.
My whole legend story. It's three chapters, but he did all that. And he did a book that I did an image called Oliver with Gary Whitta and Ballistic. And I usually ask for him or Tony Avina, who did all my boys coloring. Those two guys are my go-tos. If one's not available, I usually ask for the other.
Awesome. Yeah, that's pretty cool that you know, in that industry, you you find people that do a great job and you can continually work together like that. And
it's kind of like being in a, it's like being in a band in that, you know, if I like being able to work with people that I know what I'm going to get. And also the nice thing about working with, you know, Diego in particular is that he's very communicative. So I send him reference and I find pictures of what I'm going for in my mind. There's a sequence, for example, in Batman that I wrote, but I wanted the wall to change color behind him. So it's like a siren, like when you're at a crime scene and the and it's lit up. He also colored Hellblazer Rise and Fall that I did with Tom Taylor recently. Diego was the colorist on that. And we did the same thing there where I had like the figures change colors in between panels. So you get a sense of a siren, you know, like flashing. And he did a great job of it. I found some pictures online of actual crime scenes and he brought that to the page. And then that, it gives it a pulse, you know, and that way also like if it's moody or if it's, I want a certain effect from something, like he's there to bring that. So he's really a good collaborator.
Awesome.
So I saw one of your, in your bio, one of the things that you helped with was the Punisher. Do you have sort of like a thing for like anti-heroes? Because go ahead.
Yes and no. I mean, I've worked with a lot of writers that do. I mean, I think Garth Ennis's voice on the Punisher is unsurpassed. He brought that character up so many levels. He and Steve Dillon, when they were first were doing that for Marvel Knights, like they brought the Punisher up to a from a good, I'd drawn him once before without, before Ennis took over. And he was wearing like a ponytail and, you know, I just stuff that I don't think the Punisher would do.
Right.
And Ennis was the first one to go like, no white gloves, no white boots, tactical gear. That was all him because he's a kind of a weapons expert. And, you know, so they brought me on to fill in for Steve Dillon on a few issues. And I did this, hilarious two-issue story where he fights Wolverine. He blows his face off with a shotgun and Wolverine's just running around with, like a skull. You know, we ran him over with a steamroller at the end. And, it, you know, and I love Wolverine, but for me, I'm like, hey, I'm drawing Wolverine. It's the same attitude I brought to the boys. Like, hey, I don't care. I'm getting to draw superheroes that I designed, you know, and illustrating Garth Ennis script. I was happy, you know.
That's awesome.
So a lot of the writers I work with are big into the anti-hero characters. I think the only anti-hero character I've ever been really super fond of is Wolverine because he's unlike everybody else, you know, and I fought really hard to make sure that he'd stay short and 5'3" and, you know, and in the time of the movies, that wasn't so easy to do. But
well, since you're doing Batman, I recommend you do the Red Hood. That'd be a good, okay. Enough said.
Let's just say you're going to be happy when they announce the. Oh, I think they may have announced it already. Yeah, they did announce it. I can talk about it. I just remembered I saw it on online. I'm doing a Red Hood backup story in Detective, and that's coming up. So I am going to be drawing Red Hood.
Very nice.
Awesome.
Matthew Rosenberg is
looking forward to it, sir.
I was about to go. Like I can't say anything that I remembered. Oh no, they announced this. So it's okay.
Breaking
can't
news.
There you go.
Backup story in the in Detective. So I'll be doing.
All right, I'll be looking forward to it.
Red Hood in it, and it's a lot of fun. It's going to be a lot of Batman, a lot of Red Hood.
Nice.
Very nice. So, Derek, I have another question for you. As a creator, and as a fan of, you know, this whole universe of characters, Marvel, DC, you know, everything out there, do you have any favorite supervillains?
Supervillains? Yeah, I mean, immediately comes to mind is the Joker, but just because, again, he's as iconic to Batman as Batman is. You know, he's the other side of that card. You know, that's one of those things where like favorites, I'd have to think on it. I like the Cabals more than I like individual characters. So like, in, if you ask me which, you know, like, I love Flash's Rogues Gallery. I always liked all those characters, had a lot of personality. And even if that seemed a little silly, I loved them. And Captain Cold and Captain Boomerang, a lot of captains. Mirror Master, you know, I like those guys a lot. And then I liked all the Batman villains. Or, you know, it's one of the things that made Legends of the Dark Knight such a pleasure, is that when I wrote the initial outline, it was just supposed to be a Batman Joker story. And my then editor, Hank Canales, came back and said, "We really like it. We're going to give us a green light. We only have one request." And I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Can you put more villains in it?" And I went, "Yes." Because that's like, you know, you like an extra large pizza with more toppings? Well, of course I would.
More story? Of course.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, I would like more. So it was really fun. And then it actually was a nice opportunity to go in and I put my head into other characters like the Penguin and Mr. Freeze. And I had a lot of fun writing Riddler. I created a new character for that universe in this story. And that was fun because they got enthusiastic about her. So there's a new character makes her debut in part 3.
That's I'm interested in, like, when it comes to storytelling, and obviously you need so much per issue and a number of issues, is there ever a conflict with, like, pacing and, like, not to go too slow or to go too fast? Do you feel like that's kind of a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, that's I would say in the case of this story that I just wrote, it's like I had to work within 10 page chapters rather than writing a whole 22 page comic, which I normally would do. So there was a little bit of a challenge of making things interesting and happen with like a beginning and a middle and an end that makes 10 pages interesting as opposed to 20. So certain scenes I would have liked to have dragged out a little bit more. I found myself, you know, cutting down and making hard cuts and using dialogue to cover some of the transitions. But, you know, when you're challenged by something, it tends to make you stronger. So I think that as a writer, I was able to kind of grow on this because, you know, and I also don't like myself very much when I'm drawing the stories that I write, because I have a lot of imagination when I'm just working on a keyboard. And when I actually have to sit down and make it work visually, I curse myself. Like, what was I thinking? I could have just, you know, wrote them in a snowstorm and not have to worry about any backgrounds at all. And ended up writing myself a very complicated ending.
Yeah, and another thing, because Batman, but you know, but you know, I haven't picked up the issue, but now talking to you, I definitely will pick up the issue. So congratulations on getting a sale. When it comes to the Batman, he is an iconic, definitely mass produced type character where you've had multiple people create their own story with Batman. Yeah. So how hard, or maybe easy, is it to make him into your image and not somebody else's?
That's the thing with Batman. It's like, it's sort of like I didn't write a story that I set out to reinvent the wheel or anything. I mean, he's Batman. The best feedback I've been getting is people saying, "Oh, I love this because it's just a straightforward Batman story. Like, I was just working in canon. That was the only direction I got going in. It's like, you can do whatever you want. It doesn't have to be in continuity. It just has to be in canon, meaning that, you know, Batman is Bruce Wayne and he, you know, all those people are going to fit the way we know them." And so I just went in and played with the classic universe. I went back to like the original costumes on the villains, you know, and made them look like my action figures that I grew up on. Awesome. And because that was, for me, like, it was like playing with them in my, you know, all over again. So for me, it was more about getting into Batman's head and trying to see the world as he would see it and trying to think about how he would respond to certain things. And, you know, and my Batman, I just kept him very, like, relatively quiet. He doesn't say a whole lot, but then there's a lot of internal dialogue going on. So you kind of, in the quieter moments, I kind of put my head into what it would be like to go through what I'm putting him through. And so there's a lot of internal dialogue going on about how he's coping with, you know, he's in a lot of pain physically because he's been awake for the story starts. He's been awake for over 36 hours and he needs to, a normal person would have like called in a night and gotten some sleep at this point. But at the end of his shift, he finds out that he discovers that there's this deal going down with some poison gas and a guy selling it on the black market, trying to get it to the highest bidder, which is all of his enemies. Like, you know, I made an observation that not a lot of people have made, but that all of his villains kind of use gas in a weird way. Somebody, Joker spits it out of his flower and Penguin's got it in his umbrella and the Joker or the Riddler puts it in packages and everybody has gas for some reason. So poison gas that's adaptable, they'd all want this. And so he's going to stop this deal from going down and he won't rest until he can. And in the process, like he goes through hell. It's like the worst, like a terrible night. That's what the story is called. Bad night, good night, with K-N-I-G-H-T, good night, but playing on words, but he goes through this like horrific, night where he suffers a lot and physically, and the only thing, and I think that's interesting because kind of like Daredevil, he's got this sonar power, but really he's just a guy, and so is Batman. Like his guy is just trained for nights like this his entire life, but he's still only human. He doesn't have, he can't just charge up in the sun and get back to work. He's a regular guy. And so if he gets, and I was thinking like, if he gets sick on the inside, that makes a huge difference, as opposed to somebody like Superman who's invulnerable. So, he's just kind of suffering through this, but then his relentlessness and his focus on getting through the mission and how, and in the midst of it, he's remembering things he's lost. He's kind of dealing with, kind of the feelings that lack of sleep and, feeling like crap would bring on. So it's being in Batman's head and kind of seeing the world through his eyes for 60 pages. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Awesome.
Maybe going forward, he'll have a gas mask on his utility belt.
He has one actually going in, but he gives it to the cops. He sacrifices his own to save somebody else's life because he's a hero.
No spoilers.
Well, Derek, I know that we're getting on to an hour, so I don't want to make you go over any of your time limits.
I appreciate that. I'm enjoying talking to you guys, but I should get back to what I was doing because I have
got a deadline coming, right? Awesome.
Always.
Thank you, sir.
Well, Derek, real quick before we get out of here, I usually just do a panel exit and then let you get to talk about yourself again where people could find you. So real quick, Harris from the Marvel Cinematic Facebook group, thank you for coming on, and can you tell people where they could find you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at PLock77, and of course you can come visit us at the largest Marvel group on Facebook, over 540,000 members and climbing. So come talk Marvel with us. Come have some fun.
And Gary?
Midway 8 Monster on Twitter. Pleasure being with all of you. Definitely fun time. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Alan?
Yep. Animated_evil on Twitter. Find out what I'm doing over there. And I want to say a massive thank you straight away to Derek for joining us.
It was really fun. Thanks for having me.
And Derek, where can we find you?
I'm on Twitter espousing my political opinions and showing off bad pictures of my youth at Derek R. And you can also find me, or if you have questions about my history and things like that, DerekRobertson.com. Also, if you have inquiries about buying original art, things like that, DerekRobertson.com is up and going. And that those two places are about all your, I don't bother with too much else.
Well, awesome. I want to say a big thank you for joining us tonight and talking with us and telling us more about yourself. It was great to get to know you And you know, I'm telling you, one of those days, if you appear at a convention, I am bringing as many Space Beaver comics that I can find. So thank you very much for being here. It was a pleasure talking to you and getting to know a little bit more and everything that you've done throughout your career.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for having me. It was a lot of fun talking to you guys. Come back anytime.
Thank you very much, Derek.
Continued success, yes, man. You're rocking and rolling it.
No, thank you, Paris. Appreciate that. Yeah. You guys have a great night.
You too. Thank you.
You too, dude.